irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Willow, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, and welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. My guest is Robert Sarzo, and he's an amazing guitar player with a killer tone, and you're going to hear that in just a second. I just want to welcome you, Robert, to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Jeff. Very excited to be here.
And he's one of the guys that basically, as a rock guitarist playing and stuff, he kind of fell into a kind of a studio gig to become a hired gun for a lot of producers. He worked with Jimmy Iovine, and he also worked with Bob Ezrin, Mike Klink, and Robert Stigwood, and was a guitar for hire that worked, overdubbed specifically a kind of a rock guitar type of thing. And we were talking a little bit before the show, and we'll go into it in a minute. The other big guys that were that type of specialty type of guitar players was Dick Wagner and Steve Hunter. And he was you were friends with Dick Wagner.
With Dick, yeah.
And you guys jammed together.
We jammed a lot at the Flying Machine, the club in Fort Lauderdale, and it was good times. I think it was like 1971. Yeah.
So anyway, I'm going to play you a clip to kind of show you what Robert's all about. This is called Living Over the Edge, and it's a great, there's some double leads, and then he just goes for it. So here's Living Over the Edge. Now, you were originally born in Cuba, and
that's
you
correct.
Emigrated here, and you moved to New Jersey, right?
Miami. We were in Miami for two years first.
And then you went, okay.
Too many Cubans in Miami, so they had to fly us up to Jersey. And so I was there for, a couple of years, and my brother and I, we were watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and there were the Beatles.
So that was your big... That's what got you into music
and
rock.
Yeah, what a great gig.
No. I remember seeing them on the Ed Sullivan. I mean, everybody was watching at the time. Yeah. So you came over, and we were talking a little bit before the show of the Cuban, especially the rhythms, had to be an influence on you. And in the earlier, when you were a child, in Cuba, you were, what kind of music was there? I mean, was it, was a lot of rhythmic?
It's all sorts of music. It's all percussions, polyrhythms. It was just all push and pull and push and pull. And my aunt was an actress, dancer in one of the casinos. And she took me to the club, and I just got mesmerized. With the fascination of all the lights and the stage, and it was, everything was pitch black, and I just fell in love with being inside of a club. And I think when I connected, you know, wow, clubs, music, entertainment, I love it.
So when you, was there a, well, okay, in Miami, did you get to, did you get to see some of the, you, is that where you saw the club scene, or was it in Cuba that you saw it?
Well, my aunt, I remember, specifically took me to that club because it was around Christmas time and they were giving Christmas toys. You know, she didn't have any children, so she that was my godmom, and she took me to the club. And but when we went to Jersey, we were there for a couple of years. We went back to Miami, and at that time, every kid in the block had a guitar. Everybody had one.
Now, this was after the Beatles were on it. So
Yeah.
Because there was a big music scene. And I mean, there was some, you know, Steve Morse and Pat Metheny. They all studied in Florida.
University of Miami. A lot of people. Jaco Pastorium, which later on I met, he bought my clarinet piano. but, I mean, you know, we left everything behind. So we were very poor. Very poor. I had to build everything. I had to, you know, create anything that I wanted to do. No one handed me anything. So it actually, I am very grateful for everything that I have and everything that I have created from nothing. I'm used to putting bands together since I was 14 and put it to work. And typing my own contracts, hustling, getting the clubs. I did the same thing later on. I went to New Jersey because I got so frustrated that Miami, just after the 70s, it was really a lot of heavy rock going on there. And I was working 7 days a week and going to school. I would stay up, going to school after the gigs, and then take a nap, go back and do it again, night after night. And that's how I bought my Les Paul, my Gibsons, Marshalls, everything. I was earning my own money.
Now, in New Jersey, you were gigging up there?
Later on, I went to Jersey, and I stayed there. And I was putting bands together at the same time answering ads. And there was one that the guitar player from Todd Grundgren, the bass player Cassium was actually putting a gig together. I called them, I went into the audition, and the guitar player goes, "Hey, I'm leaving this band because I'm going to be playing the gig that you want." So he handed me another gig, and I went to audition at Star Rehearsals in Manhattan, and the band didn't even know this guy quit on them. So I was the delivery man to tell them, "Hey, you just lost your guitar player, but here I am." They're like, "Who the hell are you?" So they had a strange attitude, but Jimmy Iovine was there, and it was through Arista Records. 2 weeks later, I was in the studio cutting with Shelly Yagos, Jimmy Iovine in Manhattan. I jumped in that gig so quick. I was so ready. And the album is called This Day and Age. Great album. And we were getting ready for the second album. And this is after all the touring that we did. And we had that song, Shadows of the Night, the Pat Benatar hit song. Well, D.L. Byron, you know, wrote that song. And Clive David goes, "You guys don't have a hit." So he let the band go. He let the artist go. And that was a great band. That was Tommy Price on drums, which still plays with Joan Jett. He did a lot of sessions with Billy Idol. He played.
What was the name of the band?
D.L. Byron. David Lawrence Byron. D.L. Byron. The album's called This Day and Age. And it's on the internet. It's a great album. It's all new wave. And that's when I hooked up with Robert Stickwood for the movie Times Square.
Oh, okay.
Jimmy was producing that music for that. And I played also with a reggae artist, Garland Jeffries from New York.
Yes, I saw that on the bio. That was kind of cool.
I'm very versatile.
You toured with Bob Seger, too.
We opened up the Bob Seger arena tour when I was, I think, 24 years old. I was doing a radio arenas. And this is in 79 when we cut the record. We went on tour immediately in 1980. So I was already doing the whole tour.
Arenas. Auditioned for this group, D.L. Byron.
Yeah.
So what were you using?
Plexiglass Marshall. Actually, you know, like SIR, they had their own backline there. So I just went in with my Les Paul, my 1971 Les Paul that I had installed myself, humbuckers from 1961 pickups from my ES-335. Mm. And I did all the wiring myself. Again, you know, when you're poor, you got to learn how to electronics. You learn how to do everything on your own.
Well, also, too, I think that as a and as becoming a studio player, I've talked to other musicians about this, too. We made the guitars to what we wanted them to be. They weren't exactly just off the shelf. We ended up almost every guitar I have has been modified in some way or another just to get it to play what I wanted. Yeah. But, you know, yes, part of it, you didn't have the money to have a tech do that. But also, too, if I remember back then, there wasn't that many techs that were doing that kind of stuff. It was more trial and error. I don't know about
some places had, you know, other people that would actually.
The big touring acts. Yeah. But from what I even remember, I mean, there were people here doing mods in L.A. and stuff, but we were basically just experimenting on our own.
Guitar is not that old. It's not that old of an instrument. So, yeah, like scalloping, when I was on tour with Hurricane, I got bored, and I was designing all these Ibanez guitars. I was the first mm-hmm. heavy metal guitar player with Ibanez. So I designed the whammy bar, the whole thing, the shark tooth on the fretboard. Mm-hmm. That's my drawing from my own signature model.
Oh, wow.
And they're still using that. And Larry DiMarzio has his pickups on Ibanez guitars because I made a phone call. I called Larry, and I was already endorsing him. And I already came back from Japan. And I told the people over there in Japan, I said, you got to get rid of these pickups. Look, my guitar has DiMarzio's.
So you were an early endorser of DiMarzio. So did you tell them what you wanted?
Yeah. With Steve Blucher and Larry. And I will make the calls. I said, I want pink pickups. They're like, what? Yeah, I want pink pickups.
Oh, okay, the bobbins.
Yeah, the really odd colors, green. So, yeah, I was.
But, I mean, the terms of the sound, did you use the super distortion or did you use a PAF type?
PAF, yeah. And I was using Plexiglass Marshall Super Bass 100.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Super Bass.
Oh, that was the baby. And then I had Jose Modify here in L.A. that did Eddie's amps and the, Remember Jose back in the day?
Yes, And there was two other guys that were doing major much.
Lee Jackson.
Lee Jackson. I think it was Jerry Blaha did a Marshall mod where he did a mid-boost.
Didn't work.
And Rivera.
On Rivera, of course, yeah.
Yeah, but he was more with the Fenders. He did more of the mods.
Great sound, too. They're all great, yeah.
So, yeah, but I remember, those were the but the Super Bass 100, that was the popular. That was the one everybody wanted
to
use.
Don't have them anymore. And I had the original greenbacks, the little 25 watts with the bottom cab.
Did you have the bigger cabinets like Hendrix used?
Yeah.
The oversized ones?
Yeah. No. I have 412 greenbacks.
Right, but there was a 412 that Hendrix used that was bigger. It was a bigger cabinet, but it was still 412.
I don't know. It was big.
It was deeper. It was a deeper.
It was the deep. Yeah, it was big, deep, heavy. I had to lug it around.
Was Hendrix a big influence with it? Now, you were in New York. You must have seen. Were you near Greenwich Village and stuff? Did you check him out?
No, I saw Hendrix in 1968 in Miami Beach. I took a bus. I wasn't supposed to take a bus. My parents would have been very upset, and no one wanted to go. I went to see Hendrix. Couldn't get tickets. Probably didn't have the money, to be honest with you. I snuck in,
and that's
cool. I'm so glad I did. It totally changed my aspect as to what a guitar player soloist should be doing.
Now, he was, at that time, because I've seen a concert in Florida, and he was using Super Showmans. He was using the Showmans. Was he using that, or was he using the Marshalls?
I think it was Marshall.
That's interesting. So you were always using Marshall?
Fender Twins, but they were too clean. And I tried all different combinations of speakers. It was just too clean. Even the Plexiglass was too clean, so... I figured out how to do the mod myself and put a master volume on the Marshall.
Mm.
And for those people that don't know, and those amplifiers, you can take the positive coming out of the treble potentiometer, and that is your line that you put the potentiometer in there. I think it's a 500K.
Mm-hmm.
And that once you do that there, that's your cutoff point, And then you have, that's your master volume. And it's on the treble controller.
So you would push the preamp more than you'd push the power tubes?
That way you can turn the power amp down because of those goddamn things. I mean, I used to take them apart and get zapped and be thrown across. I would demagnetize, you know, the...
Yeah, but would you able to get a... Because one of the things about the Plexi was...
It's too loud.
I know, clean. But it had that sound, those power tubes. Like, I was talking to somebody else the other day about rocking the Fillmore, which was the 100 waters half stacks that Frampton and Steve Marriott was... Wally Stalker from the Babies, he was talking about that. But that sound is the power tubes just full up.
Yeah.
That was a great...
Yeah.
But it sounds like on... Like, okay, well, let's talk a little bit about Living Over the Edge. That lead, that was a Marshall, right?
That was a Marshall. That was a loaner from Scott Sheets, guitar player Pat Benatar.
Mm-hmm.
He loaned me his Marshall for that because at the time I was really doing an experiment. I didn't use my Marshall at that time for some reason. And I was just, you know, Bob kept bringing in different things. He even had the Gallen Kruger from David Gilmour. I used that also for dubbing. The it's not digital transistor, right?
Now, that lead that you're doing, there's a little bit of chorusing in there. Was that a chorus or were you doubling?
That was after the fact.
Okay, that was... Yeah. Because I know that one of the things, I was reading in your bio about you almost ended up on the with Ozzy replacing Randy Rhoads. But he used to triple track, and he would get that, it would phase.
It's a phasing because it's not perfect, which that's the beauty of it.
And it had that sound, but I was wondering if that was that, is that how you got that sound, or did you, they actually processed it?
That was the magic of Bob Ezrin mixing it. He's magical. But, the parts were there, and then he just took it further, you know.
Well, let me play another clip. I'm going to play, this one's interesting because I think you're using an effect on this one. I'll ask you what you did on this. This is and there's a cool little rhythm thing at the beginning. This is called Not Yet. Let me play this for you. And this is from your solo album that came out after the storm, if I'm correct.
Yes.
Okay, let's take a listen to this. Now, was that done after the fact, or did you do that with a pedal?
I tracked that because I didn't want anybody to change it on the mix. Garth Richardson mixed that, and he was Bob Ezrin's engineer. And Garth Richardson's father is the one that gave Bob Ezrin his break with Alice Cooper. Bob Ezrin's father is a famous producer in Canada. I produced his album.
Oh, wow. So how did you do that guitar sound? Was that that wasn't a pedal, or was that
a harmonized? That was a combination. I think that was, at the beginning, it was four guitars perfectly in sync playing.
Wow.
Yeah. And I used a Metatronics amplifier, but I had it so it wasn't that overdrive, because what happens is when you're tracking a lot of multi-tracks, the saturation of all the tracks is going to increase the harmonic distortion. So you got to go a little cleaner. That's the trick. So a lot of cats don't do that. They just do it. You know, they just...
Well, a lot of times in sessions where they had me play a blowout sound, I would either run direct from the guitar so they got a clean track of it, or I would do an overdub and do it again clean, and then they would mix a little bit so it would give you a little more articulation because it would just get so fat.
It would get so fat, and especially nowadays when you're running Pro Tools, you can do different apps, you can do that. I still really enjoy doing the all tube amps. And yeah. I'm using the Ruby tubes, and they just gave me that great compression. I don't even use a compressor pedal.
You don't need to when you push the tubes.
I want the compression to come from my hands, the synchronization of my left hand, my right hand, my picking, my muting. I really barely use the guitar pick.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of it. It's just the pinch harmonics. I use it for that, but it's all a lot of my hands. You see, a lot of the times, just I'm just playing with my fingers.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you use on that? Not yet. What was it? Because you're overdubbing a lot of guitars.
A lot of guitars, and it gave it that tone, and also I think it was a little bit of a chorus pedal that I had, a analog pedal. Got to remember, this was recorded back early 90s.
Okay.
Right after Hurricane, and Nick McCavito kept the option. They wanted me to do a solo record, and this album, the band was Sarzo. So this would have been the...
But the album came out in 2013?
That's correct.
These were early tracks that you were...
Enigma closed down. And then RCA was picking it up because it was rocking Espanol, and they wanted to release it also in South America. And the gentleman that was involved in it left the company. And then it was just left alone. And I kept the master. I owned the master. And then my wife at the time was diagnosed with cancer, Susie. So at that moment, it's like one of those times in your life you got to go, wow, what's really important here?
Yeah, you got to deal with things.
And I wanted to make sure my son was taken care of, and so I did, and I'm glad I did.
Well, what guitars were you using there? When you started layering those type of guitars?
Those are the Ibanez.
Those are all Ibanez?
Yeah, the 550s.
Oh, wow.
Great guitars.
550s.
With the Marcio pickups, and then, you know, the bridge is the humbucker, so is the neck, and then in the middle is the Strat pickup.
Oh, okay. So you had the two, did you have splitters on? Was it able to split?
I like that tone. I like to be able to.
Because you're getting like a single coil thing,
funky.
And you can hear it like that. That like octave thing that you were doing, that do 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 do, it sounded like that.
Yeah,
a single
and
coil
and a lot of muting, a lot of the.
Here, let me.
Yes, that you gotta do the percussion.
When you do that run like the octave, do 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 do, it's a kind of a Hendrix type.
Yeah, it's just the funk. It's just playing funk. Is when I was. I should say stuck in Miami, and rock and roll, you know, just got trashed. I mean, everybody had to leave Florida. I wanted to play, you know, metal, because Florida was really rock and roll oriented back in the early 70s, and this disco came in, and it was so strong that if you wanted to work, you had to play disco. So I would do Barry White music, and I would do the bowing and the guitar to get the orchestration. I would do the wah-wah pedal with the hammer-ons to get the piano, because I sold my clarinet to Jaco. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, shit. I cursed. Sorry. How am I going to play those parts? So I had to invent how to do hammer-ons. This is back in Miami. I didn't know about Eddie Van Halen.
Well, show us what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I was doing with the wah-wah pedal, and then I was doing... So you're going... So you would do, you know, funky parts. I would have to go back to one of those funky things that I was doing.
Well, it's interesting with the disco happening. Wasn't the funk stuff, didn't that stuff survive? Weren't there funk bands playing the clubs, or they just didn't want to have any?
No. Everybody was playing disco. Everybody was playing. Yeah, if you wanted to work, and I was used to working.
Mm-hmm.
I want to work. I love working. And so we would play Led Zeppelin kind of disco style, really funky, which worked, because if you listen to John Bottom and John Paul Jones, I mean, those are really funky riffs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Great chops. I mean, John Paul Jones, a great funk player.
Well, before the disco thing invaded Florida, what was the scene like? What kind of stuff was it? Southern rock bass, or was it British metal. Bass?
It was British.
But more metal, like Zeppelin, or was
everybody
it?
Played under Zeppelin, Bowie. It became glitter rock also.
Really? Because it's interesting because, you know, you have Criteria. And
That was later.
Oh, that was later. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
The Bowie, the British Invasion, all that. You see, all these guys were hanging out, you know, guys from New York that would go to Florida because it was so nice weather-wise, and you can still, you know, rehearse.
Is that where
and work
you,
on a record.
You said you hung out with Mick Ronson. Was that where you met him?
Is Mick Ronson in New York. No. Mick Ronson was in New York City at, I think maybe that was IRS Studio. We were doing pre-production for the record. Or the tour, and Mick Ronson went in there because he knew Jimmy Iovine, and he loved my Les Paul that I had at the time, and so he picked up the bass, started jamming with us.
That's cool.
With Tommy Great. Price on drums, and yeah, and you know I love you know Mick Ronson.
Oh yeah,
I mean, Bowie tracks.
Legend.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, and I met Bowie also at back in the day when he first started out the first tour.
Now, when you went up to New York, was the scene different? From what
it
you
was,
saw, I mean,
yeah.
in
it
what,
was hard.
Well, no, okay, no,
yeah, yeah. And it was different. It was becoming more punk, more new wave.
Oh, okay. So when you went up there, yeah. That was starting to happen.
Max's Kansas City. I saw Blondie there when she was starting out. So when I got that gig with Dio Byron, I cut my hair. My hair was really long, metal, you know, down mm-hmm. to my waist. And I figured, well, if I'm going to go on tour, there's a video out from Listen to the Heartbeat. And you can see the whole change that I did. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. It was great playing a lot of eighth notes. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, real staccato, real even.
And you were using the Ibanezes there?
No. I started doing the Ibanez when I came to the West Coast because it seemed like that was the trend.
Right.
And I, you know, it was like, oh, something new, whammy bar, you know, because I had a Strat before and that thing never stayed in tune. So when I...
That's right. That was before the Floyd Rhodes, right?
It wasn't around yet. Yeah, yeah. So no, the whole East Coast, I was doing the traditional ES-335, Melody Maker, Les Paul.
Okay, so you were a Gibson pretty much.
I was a Paul guy, yeah.
And so when you got to the West Coast that you started using the Fenders?
I started experimenting. No, more of the Ibanez.
Really?
Ibanez approached me because I had an invention for them. And Wayne Thompson, I think it was one of the reps at the time. This is 1983. And they go, hey, check out these guitars. You know, and we're trying to figure out the whammy bar. And it was horrible. I think it was just, you know, it wasn't the Floyd Rhodes mechanism. So think the strings
would get
stuck.
Well, had the Floyd come out by that time?
Yeah, they were out. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Because the early ones didn't. It just had the locking nut. It didn't have the locking bridge.
But the locking nut was here. They had the nut, and there was locking right here. So when you drop and you go back to 440, whatever tuning it is, the strings never really land perfectly on the nut.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mess.
Yeah, that was the problem with the Kaler.
Yeah.
Because Floyd had, they had licensed that was patented. The locking nut, at the nut.
And the only cats that were playing those, you know, the Ibanez were just jazz guys.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, the Ibanezes that you were using are the ones that looked like were Strat-type shaped, right? Like,
yeah.
Which later Vai made his guitar like that.
I was very involved with that guitar. I told Steve Vai, one of the Rock and Roll Fantasy camps that we were doing together, I said, "I was part of it was my concept." Yeah. A great neck. I mean, it's just... fabulous. And then he came out with the monkey grip.
Yeah, he had that.
Which is great. I love that.
It's easy to grab it.
Why not?
It makes it work. It really does.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
But so you were using the Ibanez and Marshalls back then?
I started out with the Marshall and then I wanted to get a little bit more grind. And then there was another company that approached me for an endorsement. I started using it and I used it on my first record with Hurricane.
Sound City? If it was Sound City, they're the precursors of Hi-Watt.
I'm trying to remember.
Because they were, I remember seeing them at Guitar Center, Sound City amps.
I remember the Sound City. I don't think it was Sound City. I gotta look it up. I know I have pictures with them. Yeah, mm-hmm. they were kind of like
when you got into the new wave and the the punk stuff, what were you using Marshall too, or did you use other types of amps?
For the tour, they didn't want me to bring my own Marshall. They didn't want to do that. They leased everything from SIR, so I chose the Mesa Boogie.
Ah, how'd you like that?
I liked it a lot. It was easy to get, you know, to have the tech to bring around and set up. It was easy. And then it happened that Bob Seger, the band had the same setup. So did Bob Seger, but his blew, so he started using my...
Well, did you rent from SIR to tour with, or did you have...
For the tour, yeah.
So they just rented you one system that you took with you?
Yeah, management had everything rented.
Okay, but you took it with you. It wasn't like each city had a different setup.
No. It was all. We had a truck. We had the bus.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was there. It sounded great. I was using an old Tele, 1962 Tele.
Oh, wow. That would
That's
work.
Another one that I grew up with, too.
Oh,
the
okay.
Teles. And now I'm using the Tele, which is interesting, by Godin. And it's a hybrid of a Strat Tele with the Tele body. Seymour Duncan neck pickup is a P90, and it's attached to a Strat. It's all one. So when you put it on the fourth position on your five-position switch, it's really, you know, combined the two of them.
So you have a three-pickup array on a Tele type of guitar.
Yeah, but it all looks like one pickup on the neck, but that's really two pickups there. And then it's got a really badass Tele pickup. And it's
very
really
cool.
Nasty. It's got that. And it's got an overdrive, and it's got the whammy lock. You know, it's not a locking system, but it stays in tune really well.
So you're using Godin now.
Godin guitars. And I'm also using Paul. It depends the project that I'm doing.
No, I hear you.
Yeah. You know, when I was out with Queensryche, the Garmo used a lot of the Gibson's Les Paul.
Uh-huh.
So I went to the Gibson's. Mm-hmm. I started using more of the Gibson sound.
Well, you brought in one of the Godins, and this is a new one that you were telling me about. That
this just came out. Yeah, this is brand new in the market. It's the Multiac Spectrum SA, and I was really one of the first heavy metal MIDI guitar players back in the 80s. I was endorsing Korg and the NIVO out of Canada. But everything was through MIDI. And for those people that don't really understand MIDI, it's musical instrument digitally interface. So you're getting the analog signal, and it actually will translate it into digital.
Right.
So therefore, you can, you know, signal all your digital devices.
It allows you to use, like, samplers or...
whatever that's digital, yeah. So this guitar, this Godin guitar, it's black. It's got ebony fretboard, 22 frets, really sweet... frets. The action is just sick. It's so good. And I'm using right now clear tone strings, 11 on the top, 48 on the bottom. And this thing, it just plays like a dream. I mean, you can...
Now, let me explain, or let us both explain what you're doing here. He has there's a Soap Bar pickup on there. And that's going to my little Marshall.
I thought it was a lipstick. It looks more like a lipstick.
That's Seymour right. Duncan, the 90s. It's a lipstick.
I love saying the lipstick.
Ooh la la. But it goes to the... That's going to the Marshall, my little Marshall. Yeah. And let me mute the line 6 for a second so you can hear the... that's the Marshall. Okay, so, and then he has the other pickup, the bridge pickup.
The bridge pickup.
I think it's a Piezo, is going into the line 6. That's the line 6 right there. And it's interesting because even with the Piezo pickup, he's getting a lot of sustain.
Oh, yeah, this guitar sustains really well. Oh, and it's MIDI. It's got a 13-pin connector so I can run my Roland synth. And, you know, I'll have strings, cellos, the whole fiasco. I can't wait to bring this.
It has a slotted headstock. I've took pictures of it. It's got a slotted headstock, so it looks like similar to a classical.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has a whole bunch of electronics in there to allow him to contour and set up the sound.
And you can change the settings also on your MIDI here on the face of the guitar. Also, this guitar, you can crank the hell out of it, and will not feedback. Because I have the classical version of it, which is really notorious too.
You know, is that a solid body or is that hollow?
It's got a semi-hollow, but tune really well, too.
It's holding pretty well, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, that's a mahogany neck, mahogany body, right? Is that a maple top?
I don't know the top. I can
and is that
up.
An ebony board? It looks like ebony.
Ebony, yes.
Yeah, it's an ebony.
That's what gives it that tone.
And it's a bolt-on. It's a bolt-on on the guitar, but it's a beautiful guitar.
And it's really easy to play if you want to play with your fingers. You can do it. See, that's an acoustic guitar.
It's interesting. The clear tone strings give you enough overtones where you can get that acoustic sound.
You can.
I was kind of amazed when you were using electric guitar strings on it, but it's getting a lot of it's got a lot of character to it.
You know, another thing that I like about the clear tone strings, Jeff, is that they are treated, not coated. And I live in a yacht. I'm on the water, and all the strings just will rust.
Oh yeah.
And these
your electronics will get corroded. Yeah.
But it's actually good for the wood.
Really?
The moisture is very good. Yeah. It's the dry, hot, dry.
The problem with the electronics is the salt.
The salt. And it doesn't touch the salt. You know. And they're always going out. They're always gigging.
You're taking them out. A friend of mine, he had a Strat that his cousin gave him back. It was a 61, and it was sitting at the beach. And we had to replace all the pots. It was all green from all the corrosion from the salt.
You know, funny enough to say, because in Falardo, when we were gigging a lot in Falardo, Miami, back in the day, a lot of the hardware on the drums would get totally rusted.
Yeah.
And the pots and the guitar, yeah.
You got to be careful, but that's great. Yeah. No, this is a beautiful guitar.
Oh, yeah.
You guys got to check this out. It's the Multi-Act Spectrum XA.
It's got the 22 frets, which is what I like.
Yeah, it's easy access. It's a cutaway, so you can get up there. But what I like how you have it set up is it's just got a little bit of distortion in it, so it gets a kind of a nice bloom to it, and it you get a nice cool sound. It's an interesting sound.
I just wrote to the rep this morning. I go and they're in Canada. This guitar is handcrafted. I mean, this is Canadian handmade guitar. I said, I cannot stop playing this guitar.
No,
it's
they're beautiful.
So much fun. And the other one, too. And the classical one, too. The classical, it's got the traditional fat flamenco neck.
Now, do you, you're, besides the semi-acoustics that these are, do you use their electrics?
Yeah, the...
The one like the Les Paul one?
No, I don't.
Which electric do you use?
I have a Tele version.
Oh, a Tele one. Okay.
It was just smoking beautiful. That's the one that I have a picture of the ad that I made in Guitar Player Magazine August issue this past year, and that's the guitar.
That's the guitar?
Yeah, yeah, and it sounds like it should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's got that, you know, bolt-on sound.
No, Godin's doing they're doing it right. They're making a great,
and the pricing is really really good.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to mortgage your home to go out and get an amazing guitar.
Yeah,
refinance your home because you want to buy another guitar.
No, yeah. And then also too. Now you've been using you still use like Marshalls. Or you use tube amps?
Well, what's going on...
Because you're using line 6, too. That's what you're using here tonight.
Yeah, yeah. That's my pod, and I always use my wireless line 6. And I also used their cabs, the Bogner cabs, the Line 6, mm-hmm. which they have the Celestons 90s and 30s. I'm always experimenting. And so I used a lot of the Line 6 gear. On tour with Queensrÿche, I was actually using the HD500 straight through the board. Mm-hmm. So all those gigs that we did in Brazil with Aerosmith, you know, Monsters of Rock, what people heard in the main on the PA, that's what it was, the HD500 foot pedal. It was all programmed.
The whole unit's in the foot pedal.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, you didn't use the rack one.
No. Just brought the pedal board. Just hooked it up to any system. And that way, you know, nowadays when you fly, you can't, you know, bring your own gear to Brazil. It's going to cost you a lot.
But now, did you set the whatever the amp, the backline amp that you had, was that set clean? And then you did all your distortion and all that stuff was through?
Let's say if it's a Marshall 2000 or a Marshall 900, Jeff, what you do is just, you know, as you know, you put it through the line in.
Oh, okay.
And then you run the XLRs straight through the PA, so you go through the wedges, and you go also to the in stereo.
So you're not pushing the tubes on the amp.
No.
The
power tubes you are.
You are, so you're distorting them?
The EO-34s.
You were
A little. Yeah.
Because you're getting most of your gain from the pedalboard.
It's already programmed because I wanted to get the closest sound to Empire and Mindcrime, you know, Operation Mindcrime. Mm-hmm. We were doing the anniversary of Mindcrime.
Oh, wow.
So that was for that.
Now, when you were setting up those sounds to do that, what did they originally use? Did he use Marshalls?
Marshalls, yeah. That was the amp.
So
you could get
that tone. That's very cool.
Yeah, and it worked. It worked great. Easy to, you know, bring around.
Uh-huh. Now, when you did your solo album, how did you approach? Now, that it spanned over years.
I was using Metaltronics head. Mainly, that's what
Metatronics,
I used.
Metaltronics, and that's, what is that, like an EL-34?
That was Lee Jackson's version of a Marshall. EL-34s, 12AX7s.
Okay.
And that was his amp. First, he started out right by the country club in Reseda. Mm-hmm. And he had a shop there, and he would modify amplifiers. And then he started coming out with his own rack. And then he came out with his own amplifier, the Metaltronics. And for some reason, it needed a change. So at the time, also, I was using the Crate amplifiers for backstage. Mm-hmm. And I still use one. It's actually
a practice room.
Yeah. So I knew that Ampeg, they wanted to do some changes. So I called the rep at Crate, and I said, hey, I got somebody here that will be great for your company, Lee Jackson. Mm-hmm. I connected Lee Jackson with Crate and Ampeg. He was gone. He went to St. Louis Music, and I got him that gig over there. And he created some great, you know, Ampegs.
That recent one that he did that there was like a 112 and a 212 version? They sounded really good.
This is...
came out about 3 or 4 years ago?
No, we're talking back late 90s. Late 80s.
Late 80s.
Yeah.
So that was those tube ones, those 40, they had like that kind of weird Tolux to them?
Yeah, it sounded great.
Those are word fucks. Those are great
amps. If you can get it. Even the Metaltronics had its own sound, but that's what I was doing. That's what I used in the record. Mm-hmm. But I record everything analog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you don't you go to tape and then dump it into Pro Tools?
No, there was no Pro Tools involved. No everything Pro Tools? Editing was cut, a real old school. This is 1990.
Now, okay, and then with your amp, what kind of speakers are you just...
Celestons.
Greenbacks or any...
Why did I use...
Creambacks or the golds?
There must have been the greenback, yeah.
Greenbacks?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Pretty standard.
I'm a big fan of those greenbacks. I mean, that's what a greenback...
How did you mic them? Do you remember?
57s.
57s.
I like it. Kind of an angle going in right to the middle. Yeah, and you move them around, you know.
Yeah.
And then I brought in Garth Richardson, you know, later. I played it for him. It's like, yeah, I want to mix it. So he did a great job mixing it.
And then did you ever experiment pulling distant miking the amp in the studio?
Yes, I did. And thanks to Jimmy Iovine, because Jimmy and Shelly Yak has taught me
that
at the record
plant.
I sent you a picture I followed the microphones. I walked in. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, I feel really special. At the record plant, I mean, there must have been like 12 microphones all over the whole damn room.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. So they would mic the whole room.
And they used it for ambience. They didn't use any reverb, just whatever was in the room from miking. Yeah.
Because I had done a session where they had three mics. They had a 57, about a foot and a half off the center of one of the Celestians. Mm-hmm. This was a Marshall. And then they had an A414 about 6 feet away. Mm-hmm. And then they had a Neumann U87 about 16 feet away.
Yeah.
And then he spent about 30 minutes just blending that. But that's that huge sound.
It's a hit and miss, and you got to move around. And I like also, like you said, further back, but facing the corner.
Yeah, I've seen that too, where they kind face away the wall, yeah, so you get the slap from the wall.
The slap, kind of like the same thing that Bose, you know, when you the reflex
of a
Bose speaker.
And then if you're in a room like the record plant, you get you have the room. Yeah. I mean, that's a key part if you have a great live room.
Yeah, but some of the I remember I was doing one of the recordings and it bled to Costello. What was his name?
Elvis.
Elvis Costello. Yeah, it bled into his track. It came into our session. It's like, can you do me a favor? Can you turn that down? No, it's playing too loud in the room. We took it way in the far back Studio C at the record plant in New York. And I guess his room, he was doing vocals. It was right next to it. And, poor guy.
Because I remember guys would pull some mics down the hall. They mic'd, I think Hendrix one time mic'd the bathroom. Put the cabinet in the back in the bathroom to get the reflect. I mean, all sorts
so many experimental things that you can do. Mm-hmm. But that's how I like to track. I like to just experiment, step outside the box. I did also music for The Collector, the movie The Collector, which is a scary movie. It was a feature. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of the sound effects. It was just like really experimenting with tunings and not sleeping on purpose so I can get into that, you know, really bad vibe of playing. So you got to play really bad.
Well, another question I want to ask you is working with somebody like Ezrin or Jimmy Iovine, did they pretty much just let you play, or did they show you like settings? Were they very picky about setting the amp up? Or
with Jimmy Iovine, I was fortunate to have Shelly Yackas. I was very green. All I had was a 4-track recorder, and I was just experimenting on my own. So when I went into the record plant, I'm like, just tell me what to do. So Shelly did a lot of teaching me how to get the exact volume at the right tone. And then I was just doing my own playing, but no one told me what to play. And that's one thing that they used to call me back, because as they were playing the track, as they were setting up the board, because it wasn't digital, so everything was just on tape. You open up the tape, and then you got to do all the EQs. Mm-hmm. While they were doing that and playing the track, I was already in my head writing parts for it. So when it was time to track, I already knew all the layers of everything that I was creating already from listening to the track that they were, you know, setting up. So, no, they never told me really what to play. I created the parts.
But they didn't tweak your amp, or they wouldn't go
over it? Shelly did. Yeah, Shelly was brilliant, brilliant engineer. And Bob Ezrin, because it was done also with Mike Klink, Mike was very involved in, you know, with the sound with me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's so much you can do to a Marshall, you know.
Yeah.
Once you get into that stage. But, yeah, Mike helped out a lot, too. I like working close with producers, and I like to listen. I'm a very good listener.
Mm-hmm.
I like
Did they have you track overdub a lot, or did you play?
Oh, yeah.
Did you play with a section? Did they try to do a live, like, rhythm section?
What we would do is a live track, and that was mainly to get the killer drum parts, to get the drums.
Oh, okay.
And then the bass would come in.
Because a lot of times we do a live section, like maybe like bass, piano, drums, and guitar. The leakage was the secret. The leakage of like from the piano, the drums, that would end up being mixed into the drums to give to give that huge sound. It was leakage is like
the
it's the coolest thing if you know how to use it right. It can get that sound.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. We pretty much put everything, because we were in really high end studios. Not that you weren't, but I'm saying they really isolated us in different rooms.
Yeah.
And I like to record live. I'm one of those guys that it's about the vibe. I want to, you know, if you get the vibe, sometimes I'll be tracking at home to demo my parts, and I want to keep it. Mm-hmm. Because it just had, it was 3, 4, 5 in the morning, mm-hmm. and I just had that perfect vibe. It's all about the vibe.
Oh, yeah. And that's, well, that's a thing, yeah. That feel of working with the section must have been just, I mean, when it works, it works.
And that's the beauty now, as you were saying, to record direct and also with a microphone, is that if we capture that vibe, now we can save it as a stamp. And we can keep that and bring it to the big studio.
Well, would Ezrin and Iovine run a clean track of you at the same time?
No, it was all analog.
No, but they wouldn't run, like, they wouldn't let you get a clean part of your...
No. And most of the things, the effects that I was running, I did it live. Mm. Because I didn't want anybody messing around with it. And another guy I learned later on was David Gilmer did the same thing, too. I don't know if he still does. Because that way no one will mess with
He had a whole rack system of stuff besides his pedal board.
You track the sound, the delays, the tempo, you do that.
Yeah. If you have the tracks, if you have that luxury of the tracks. And back in the 8-track days, we didn't have that.
Sound and sound, you lose all the generations.
You'd have to process after the fact, but it was
all the noise.
But it was nice to be able to let you know put. You know, that's one of the cool things now with Pro Tools. You can put all those guitar tracks.
That's great.
You can send it through 5 amps and layer it, and then you can pull what you want out of it.
Yeah. But I've gone back now. I'm actually more to the basic. I rarely use any pedals. I use my little Overdrive Vintage MXR pedal. Mm-hmm. It's just an Overdrive pedal. With a little magical voodoo switch on it.
Very cool.
It gives me that growl. And then I use the Moore pedals for the delays and the reverb. I got a harmonizer in one set at one setting. And no volume pedal. I'm doing everything by hand. I want to keep it simple.
I think that we go through a cycle where we're using the effects. And you were in that era where everything was effects. It was chorusing and phasing, and everything was going on. And then you go back. It goes like in a cycle. So, there's something to be said about just a guitar and an amp.
And then I really complicated my life when I saw MIDI.
Yeah.
So I started dragging all these cables, 50-foot cables. We would play Rockefeller in Manhattan, New York City, and I'm dragging all these heavy cables. I couldn't even be free and be wireless like everybody else because I was running MIDI. But it's such a full sound. I mean, if you put it on hold and you got cellos and violins going on, and on top of that, I am bowing the guitar to
Well, the other thing that people don't realize that the cool thing with MIDI is you can control other parameters. So, like, for example, you could be playing your guitar and you have a lead with a multiple echoes and it's got like a stadium reverb. And then as you progress through, you can trigger from your MIDI. You can trigger and all of a sudden you're in a little small room with a slap echo and you can change in the middle of the song. It's
Right. That's true. Yeah, because you can control your effects and your sounds if you have samplers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a you whole can do that. Crazy world.
A great synthesis, Vangelis, what he would do is he would use like a digital reverb, and then he would dial the room so it would get small in real time or get bigger in real time. And when you hear that, it's an interesting effect. Think about playing in a bathroom with a small reflective room and dialing and having the room literally expand while you're playing. I mean, it's just mind-blowing.
Now, how does he do that with a pedal?
I'm sure he programmed it because he has everything MIDI'd through his keyboard and he has a full console that's all automated. Yeah. So I would suspect he programmed it to go from here to here in the...
Another thing that I'm doing.
But it's
now,
a really, you got to try that. It's
now,
very cool.
Now that I kind of do that because I'm running the multi amp by DV Mark. Mm-hmm. And I have that program. So it's got MIDI, all the effects. So I run that direct. It's a gray rack, 500 watts, made in Italy. So, you know, the stuff made in Italy is pretty hot. So I run that direct through the PA XLR, left and right, hard panning. So I have a splitter, so I'm running a tube amp, and I'm also running the digital. Mm-hmm. So you get that ambience. You get that sound that sounds massive three-piece.
Yeah.
You get that with the rack, same thing you're talking about.
You just
about.
Have to find a digital reverb that allow you adjust the parameters via MIDI.
Yeah.
And then you can set it. You could probably set it up to do a pedal, so you can
you
actually have the
could,
pedal
with
open
the expression
it up.
Pedal, yeah.
So you can change the size of the room, but that kind of a effect. It's like when with samplers, when you would take like a flute and morph it into a string. Mm. So you play this chord of flutes, and all of a sudden it morphs into a set of violins.
And with the MIDI guitar, you can assign that to different strings.
Right.
Different frets, different part of the neck. It's just endless. I mean, it just really complicates your life. So,
but you get some interesting. I mean, it's mind blowing.
Oh, it is.
What you can do with the sound of a guitar, it just changes. It just opens up another world.
But when you're playing a sax part, you got to remember, you got to think like a sax player.
You got to phrase like,
you got to phrase it. You can't be like, oh, I'm going to play, you know, the same way. No.
No, no.
It's different modes, different scales. Yeah.
Yes. No, it's a trip.
It's very trippy.
Well, I told you we'd go by fast. We're already out of time. Oh. But I want you to mention...
I want to give a shout out to my endorsement companies that I love. And, I endorse these companies because it allows me to be my best.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to start off with Godin Guitars.
Yes.
They're great. And now also Chromacast. They make bags, cases, stands. I use my guitar cables, the cords. It's all made by Chromacast here in Los Angeles. Galaxy Audio. I'm saving my ears, so I'm using their in-ears. So anywhere on stage, even when I jump in the audience, I can still hear my guitar perfectly
Very
in stereo.
Cool.
Clear Tone Strings, which I talked about in Line 6. Peterson Tuner.
Very cool.
You want to sound professional, you got to use the best tuner. Peterson Strobe Tuners. Guys, if you haven't messed around with a strobe tuner, you know, this is the original way of tuning your pianos, acoustic pianos, and your guitars. Check out the Peterson Tuner, the Moore pedals, which I talked about, and also use Star Picks, which is made by Clear Tone. Also, the DV Mark Multi Amp. It's a digital amp if you want to go digital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I combine them. I use that and with the Ruby tubes on my acoustic amplifiers, which I endorse. I'm playing the acoustic amps, and they're all tube amps.
Now,
great sound.
Also, too, any upcoming gigs that you want to mention?
I've got a special event with acoustically with Stephen McGrath. He's the bass player of Billy Idol. We're playing in Palos Verdes on Friday. And I can send you the information. I don't know if you can post it on the...
Yeah, send it to me, and I'll post it up on the thing. Do you know what date it is? Do you have it?
Friday, March 3rd. And I will tell you exactly. It's an Irish pub, so it's going to be really, it's going to be fun there. And I haven't done an acoustic gig in years. Well, I actually did it with Jeff Tate when we were out. We would do a lot of radio station. We would perform acoustically. We would do, gigs. But the place is called let me give you the address. It is 31234 Palos Verdes Drive. That's where it is.
Okay. Send me the information and I'll post it up there and you guys can take a listen. Thank you so much for being on. I know you're coming out towards the end of the year with a new album, so we have to have you come back.
Because we haven't
even we didn't even get into all the little stories.
It's going to be another solo album. It's going to be more of a really blues album.
Blues based, so we got to talk about that. Everybody, check out the album that he has out now, After the Storm. It's really cool. There's a lot of different guitar sounds on there. And I think you're going to really like what he's doing on it. And it's very cool.
Thank you, Jeff.
I'm going to end with I'm On to You. And this is an edit of you get an idea of some of the more of the leads and the electric guitar sounds he has. Everybody have a great night. Thank you again, Robert. It's
Thank
a pleasure
Jeff.
To have you
it's
on the show.
A lot of fun.
Everybody, we'll see you next week.